But then we have what's called emotional boundaries. And these emotional boundaries are whenever you have an emotional reaction, which can be as subtle as raising your eyebrow, thinking to yourself, huh, I wonder why they looked at me that way. To like basically losing your cool because your child isn't packing their backpack in time to get out the door to go to school.
Oh my gosh, that's me every day. Literally, it's like you were there with me yesterday.
This is the Entrepology Podcast, the podcast where we optimize the bodies, brains, and lifestyles of entrepreneurs, go-getters, and world-changing innovators.
Welcome to the Entrepology Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Megan Walker. As an anthropologist and naturopathic doctor, I optimize the health and performance of badass women working to change the world as entrepreneurs and go-getters. You know, people exactly like you. Your business, body, balance, and inner badass, these are the themes that we are exploring together. Before we jump into the interview, I want to invite you to join our free Facebook community, Legacy. If you want to be something amazing, you need to surround yourself with amazing people. The Legacy community is made up of badass women living, not leaving, but living our legacy every single day. We are leaders, parents, entrepreneurs, and innovators collectively committed to leaving the world better than we found it. My mission is to support the health and optimization of these badass superheroes, literally to places we never thought imaginable. If you are on a mission and get it, that your health is the key to your unlimited potential, then join us. We are super awesome. You can find us on Facebook at www.facebook.com/groups/BE Legacy. See you there. Today's interview is important. It's important to us as entrepreneurs, as women, and as people who interact with colleagues, friends, and loved ones. Dr. Christine Bjorndal is a naturopathic doctor and an advocate for mental health. We had a fun but intense interview where we talked about her personal journey with anxiety, depression, and bipolar disorder, and how her quest to find greater health brought her to naturopathic medicine. She is a self-proclaimed recovering perfectionist and people pleaser, and we get into the habits and dialogues and ways of thinking that have the tendency to get us into trouble. Her book, Beyond the Label, addresses stigma and the ideas and ways that we can gain control over our mental health. This conversation is so important for so many reasons, and it was full of actionable items, things we can do if we are questioning our own states of mental health, but things we can also partake in as colleagues and friends and people who are seeking to advocate on behalf of those who need our assistance. Dr. Christina is an intelligent, articulate advocate for your right to gain control with respect to your mental health. She's also a heck of a lot of fun. It is my absolute pleasure to introduce you to her now. Dr. Christina Bjorndal, welcome to the Entrepology Podcast.
It's great to be here, Megan. Thank you.
Well, I'm really excited to finally have this conversation with you. We had this scheduled several months ago, and I messed up on my side, as real life happens. And I'm really glad that we were able to put this conversation together, especially on the heels of something like the Bell Let's Talk Day. We're going to have a really great conversation related to mental health, and I'm really excited to jump in. Maybe what we could do is we can start off with your journey and your story, your work, your book. These are a reflection of a deeply personal story, and I was wondering if you could share that with our audience so they have a bit of an understanding of your background and how you got here.
Yeah, absolutely. So really, it's how far back do we want to go? But I'm joking, but I'm actually kind of serious, because I think my mental health challenges actually started in utero, and I'm adopted. And I opened my book Beyond the Label with a conversation about the impact that the maternal environment, the health of the mother while the baby is in utero, and this early neurological imprinting that occurs at that time. So when I entered the world, I was a very sensitive little one and quite anxious. And that continued all the way through until high school, at which point I then developed an eating disorder. And I'll add as well that I was, or that I am, a recovering type A overachiever person. So that overachieving tendency was displayed in high school and then into university, where I pushed myself extremely, extremely hard. And then I found myself in my third year of university in a place that I'd never been before, without words to describe what I was experiencing. And that was debilitating depression, suicidal ideations, and I was still dealing with the eating disorder and riddled with anxiety. So out of concern for me, one of my best friends went to the UBC. I went to the University of British Columbia. She went to the UBC Student Services and just asked what she could do to help me. And the advice she was given was to make an appointment for me. And so I went to that appointment. I was prescribed an antidepressant, which I started, and I was labeled with depression and major depressive disorder and anxiety. And it was interesting because I'd really never heard those words, except in the economic sense of the term. I did not know anyone who was depressed. No one in my family ever talked about that. So I didn't really understand what it was. But nevertheless, I started the medication. And 4 months after that, I had a week with little to no sleep, and I spun into a full-blown delusional psychotic manic episode. Was then, it took six people, my mom, my boyfriend at the time, my two police officers, two ambulance attendants, to wrestle me into a straitjacket. And off I went to the hospital and was tossed in a rubber room, injected with haloperidol, and left there to come back down to reality. When I came out of that, I was then given the diagnosis of bipolar disorder type 1, given more medication to take, and sent on my merry way. And I still hadn't digested the first labels, and now I had this other diagnosis to integrate into my sense of self, and I didn't integrate it very well. I just lived in a lot of stigma and shame and stuffed it way down deep into a corner that I dared not to look, and just continued on with my overachieving ways, and graduated, getting a job, worked in the corporate world. And for that entire decade, when I worked in that corporate world, I was pretty much depressed for the most part and anxious. I was wearing the mask every day that everything's okay on the outside, but I'm dying on the inside. So I was quite high functioning, but not coping well at all. And I had a suicide attempt in 1994, which left me in a coma with kidney failure, waiting for on dialysis. And I was told I was going to need a kidney transplant. And I look at that time, that crisis, as a spiritual crisis. And that same friend that went to the UBC Student Services, she gave me a book to read when I was recovering for that time in the hospital, by Marianne Williamson, called A Return to Love. And in that book, Marianne has a quote on surrender, and it goes along these lines, that surrender is the decision to stop fighting the world and to start loving it in itself, loving it instead. It is a gentle melting into who we really are. We let down our armor and accept our Christ self. It is a slow melting into who we really are. And so it dawned on me at that point, I didn't love myself. I didn't accept myself. I had a lot of core beliefs, faulty core beliefs around being adopted. I didn't like the diagnoses I had been given. When I started working, my psychiatrist told me, do not tell anybody that you have this. So that really left me feeling like I had a big, black, dark mark on me. So eventually, and here I am, I'm still stuck in the pharmaceutical world. Nobody's ever talked to me about anything other than medication. And And again, this same friend, we at one point decided we were going to start a business together. She's actually a nutritionist, and she introduced me to naturopathic medicine. The business we were going to start was an organic baby formula. She's the nutritionist. We had a friend also who's a medical doctor, and myself with a business background. But really, we came together, and I think for all of us to really figure out what it is we really wanted to be doing. And it was through that journey of investigating the baby formula that I stumbled upon the Mental Health Regain Public Forum, where Dr. Abraham Hoffer was speaking in Vancouver. I attended that forum. I learned about vitamins. I know Lisa had been talking to me about them all along, but I just, was never really interested. I went to see Dr. Hoffer. He started me on a nutraceutical protocol, and that was I carried that along with my medication for a year. But that really was the first year where I was not riddled with depression and anxiety. I actually felt happy for the first time. It was incredible. And so therein lied the problem. I was in this job now, a high-stress job. By this time, I reported to the CEO. And I didn't really like what I was – I liked my staff and my team, and I liked I liked the ego side that I did report to Milton Wong, and I loved all of that. But I didn't really feel fulfilled on a deep level with what I was doing. And so I began meditating, and I've always been a big journaler, which is why I've also published a journal. But I began asking the question was posed by Cheryl Richardson on an episode of Oprah that I saw, where she said, if money didn't matter, what would you be doing with your life? And so I pondered that question. I meditated on it. I journaled, and the same answer for months kept coming up, which was, go back to school, become a naturopathic doctor, and help people regain their mental health like you have. Because when I went to see Dr. Hoffer, he was 80 years old. And I know there are lots of people struggling. And surely, I felt at that time, he can't be the only guy. Right?
For sure.
So then took me a long time to muster up the courage to leave the job and go back to high school to do the sciences, back to UBC, and then on to CCNM. And so there you go. Here I am. That's my journey in a nutshell.
Wow. And there's so many facets of what you just shared that I want to delve into. First of all, this friend of yours who's always been there, she is a winner. She's amazing.
Yeah, she is.
Maybe I'll start there because, I think this is one of the challenges with mental health is that you will have these winner friends who are like, listen, like I am stepping up on your behalf. Mm-hmm. And I want to talk a little bit about that. But then there's a lot of people who are like, I don't know what to do. Is this actually happening? If I get involved, do I make it my problem? Like, I think we intellectualize this, the relationship and the challenge that the other person's going through. And then sometimes we back out. So, mm-hmm. I think sometimes it's a matter of knowing what steps we should take. So, what would you say to those friends who may be observing something in their friends or in their family in terms of what steps can they take on their behalf to help facilitate a positive move forward? Not necessarily. Well, like where would you send them? Equip them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I think the thing is that, what Lisa said to me, she said, Chris, I was really scared. I was taking a big risk because I could have reacted or responded very differently to her extension of her hand. But so I think that's one of the first things is always setting your intention for the person that you want to help and be okay with the fact that they may not be ready to receive. But another friend of mine was telling me a story. She's a psychologist and she works in with bipolar disorder as well. She was telling me that this mother, her son was extremely depressed. And all what she did was she made him a sandwich every day and took it and put it by his bed. And apparently the boy said when he came out of his depression that that gesture of that sandwich was a symbol of, her love for him. And you really have a hard time when you're depressed asking for help. So the family members have to be able to identify the signs. And that's why it's important to understand what those signs are. And I've got that in Beyond the Label. It's outlined on page 16, but it's also in the DSM manual. They made the criteria for major depressive disorder. So people need to be more educated around what those criteria are, because depression is a very visible illness. You can see it in a person's vacant eyes, lack of expression on their face, loss of weight or weight gain. I had a pastor at one point when I had a depressive, when I was in a very deep depression, asked me if I was anorexic because I had lost so much weight. And I said to him, no, it's called depression. So there are many signs, but I think the key is to keep showing up no matter what the response is that you get and not take it personally.
Mm-hmm.
I had another dear friend that, you know, she would call and she knew I was home. I wouldn't answer the phone. Because why? I didn't want to talk. I had nothing to say. After a few times of calling, she just then would come, knock on my door, you know.
Right.
And so you have to be willing to sometimes go that extra mile for that person.
And appreciate it that it's about that person and not about you.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
And that they may not be ready for your help. They may not be ready to receive. And that's okay. But you still need to show up.
Yeah, no, I love that. And I think it's really important to acknowledge those pieces. You also, at the beginning of your story, talked about, you know, as we moved upstream in it, that you're like, I think this started in utero.
Right.
Can you expand on that a little bit? Because I know, I know we have people in our audience who are sitting there and they're pregnant. They're like, oh, gosh.
What is
happening now, right? Because as if we're not conflicted enough when we're pregnant about every last thing we do. And put some context on that for us, because I've looked at that literature as well. And I think it's actually, I think this is really important stuff to talk about. It. This is by no means mother shaming or guilt producing. This is like, let's talk about this so that we actually are informed. We can make really good choices when we know better, we do better.
That's right. Yes, and I do. That's important. And thank you for prefacing that, because I am often very, very afraid to say anything about that because of the fact that women carry so much guilt already as it mm-hmm. is, you know, as mothers. And so, but it really is at this time when you're in utero, when you're pregnant with a child, that neurological and emotional wiring begins. So the mental and emotional state of the mother or whoever it was that carried you to birth, in the case of, you know, adoption in my case, or surrogacy, results in important biological imprinting. So a lot of times when we're pregnant, what are most women focused on? They're focused on what they're eating, you know, what they're drinking, or whether or not they're smoking. And that's just working on the physical level alone. But we have to understand that there's mental, emotional, and spiritual aspects here at play as well. So I'll just quote Dr. Gabor Mate. He says, the important point to explore here is how stresses during pregnancy can already begin to program a predisposition to addiction in the developing human being. Such information places the whole issue of prenatal care in a new light and helps explain the well-known fact that adopted children are at greater risk for all kinds of problems that predispose to addictions. The biological parents of an adopted child have a major epigenetic effect on the developing fetus. Researchers from the medical school at Hebrew University in Jerusalem best encapsulate the conclusions of many animal and human studies by this quote: in the past few decades, it has become increasingly clear that the development and later behavior of an immature organism is not only determined by genetic factors and the postnatal environment, but also by the maternal environment during pregnancy. So numerous studies in both animals and human beings have found that maternal stress or anxiety during pregnancy can lead to a broad range of problems in the offspring, from infantile colic to later learning difficulties and the establishment of behavioral and emotional patterns that increase a person's predilection for addiction. So stress on the mother would result in higher levels of cortisol reaching the baby. So that's the key point here, right? Every neurotransmitter that you create while you're forming a child is going to that child.
Right.
So elevated cortisol is harmful to important brain structures, especially during periods of rapid brain development. So any woman who has to give up a baby for adoption is, by definition, a stressed woman. She is stressed not just because she knows she'll be separated from her baby, but primarily because if she wasn't stressed in the first place, she would never have had to consider giving up her child. So the pregnancy was either unwanted, the mother was poor, single, in a bad relationship, or she was an immature teenager who conceived involuntarily, was a drug user, or was raped, or confronted by some other adversity. So any of these issues would be enough to impose tremendous stress on any person, and for many months, the developing fetus would be exposed to high cortisol levels through the placenta. A proclivity for addiction is one possible consequence. So I'm just going to add here that in my family, there's four of us that are adopted between my parents, immediate siblings. And of those four, three of us had had problems with addiction.
Wow.
So that's just a small little family study of, you know, one sample size of four people, 75% of them had problems. So.
Right. Wow.
Yeah.
And so, in the population of listeners that we have for this podcast, a lot of these are mission-driven, entrepreneurial, busy women. Mm-hmm. What degree of stress? I mean, all stress. We're both naturopathic doctors. We get this. But like, how do we temper that? And how do we give context to the spectrum of stress that's available? And it's interesting what you're talking about, because I remember looking at studies coming out of China during the Cultural Revolution, where there were significant shortages of food. There was legitimate survival stress placed upon these women. And we saw two generations later these very significant and observable changes genetically and epigenetically. But these are also very extreme states of stress. Where in that normal spectrum of stress do we need to pay attention? And what are some really fundamental things that we can start to do in terms of protecting ourselves from it?
You know, it's interesting. So we talk about the top four things that get Canadians at the end of the day. So we've got heart disease, cancer, type 2 diabetes, and mental health. Those are, you know, those are in the top, at the top of conditions. But really, what's behind all of those, right? What's behind a lot of those is stress, really. So stress, we talk about this term and we use it a lot and we throw it around a lot. But what is it? You know, what does it really mean? And it can mean different things to different people, from, you know, sitting in rush hour traffic to the feelings associated with intense demands from a boss or going through a difficult divorce, right? I mean, all of these things are stress related. So I think what we have to do as people and individuals really need to pay attention to, you know, how are we feeling, and get a pulse on the stress scale. So there is a scale I have in Beyond the Label, and this is, there's, you can just Google this yourself on the internet, that's called the Holmes and Rahi stress scale. And my colleague, Dr. Marita, I don't know how to pronounce her last name very well. Do you know Dr. Marita Schwack? Anyway.
Yes, but don't ask me to pronounce her name in public either.
Yeah, sorry, Marita, if I'm butchering your name, but, she's got a book called The Adrenal Stress Connection, and she also has a great adrenal and a stress indicator in her book. So that's a really good place for people to start, is to take a look at how do they, you know, objectively rank on the scale. And then from there, get some help in terms of, well, then how do I then manage my stress? So one of the key questions that I ask patients is, you know, how do you rate your stress, and what are your stressors? What categories do they fall in? Is it financial, work, family, health, et cetera? And then how are you managing that? And for mental health, one of the things that I teach people is how to manage your mind, because the mind is the stress. And for a lot of people with depression and anxiety and bipolar disorder, the thoughts that we have is what is the problem. And so that contributes to the stress, because here's the thing, the thoughts you think affect your physiology. And this is the work of Candace Pert in her book, Molecules of Emotion, and it's the field of psychoneuroimmunology, which just is a big fancy word meaning your thoughts affect the chemicals and hormones and neurotransmitters that get produced.
Such a great book, by the way.
It is. And you know, and then we really have to enter the circle from either the thought examination perspective or the emotional side. And most people I find are out of touch with both. So, you know, I'm not sure if I'm answering your question, but
No, it's true. Like, I think part of it, and it's so right. You need to have an understanding of where your stress falls on that spectrum. And just because something is stressful for you doesn't mean it's going to be stressful for someone else, but also vice versa. Like moving can be incredibly stressful for someone, and someone else sees this as this like a liberated opportunity to start fresh, right? Like there's no definition of what's going to be the trigger for you, but it is important to have an understanding of where you're at and to be honest about that and to not have shame about that, and then engage in things like exercise or meditation or connecting with nature to help to mitigate that and manage it.
Exactly. And so another thing I do want to just mention about the stress piece of the puzzle is that Dr. Hoffer proposed back in the 1950s this concept of the adrenochrome hypothesis as a theory for psychosis and why psychosis happens, because I don't really feel that people understand, like, why does psychosis happen? So his theory was that adrenaline or cortisol, everything that we make, every hormone, every neurotransmitter has to get broken down and eliminated from the body. And so there's an intermediary byproduct in the breakdown process of adrenaline, which is called adrenochrome. And adrenochrome has hallucinatory properties to it. So his theory was that the organism, if it gets stressed so much, there's so much adrenaline flowing and coursing through the veins that this person cannot break it down fast enough. So it builds up and it's like it floods the system and it contributes to psychosis. It's kind of like, you know, a volcano. If a volcano is going to explode, there's really nothing you can do to stop it. It's not like you can put a lid on it, right? And keep it contained. So it's the same idea I feel with psychosis, is that the stress has gotten so high that the volcano is erupting and you're going to go so off into outer space, into psychosis, because the system is flooded. The circuits are frizzed out, so to speak. And so I'm 51. So I first had my first mania when I was 20. So over the last 31 years, I've had 6 episodes. And every single one of them, there has been a tremendous amount of stress involved. And I think it is the key. It is one of the keys. But for each individual, what you can, and you said it perfectly, beautifully, each individual's stress bucket is different in what they can handle. I'm quite high functioning. I have a lot of people who say to me, wow, I can't believe all the things that you've done or how you've handled that, or when I was at CCNM, I started a business. It was called the Chakra Bar. It was sold with another student, and we ended up selling it nationally across the country. This is while I was a full-time student at CCNM. People were like, how are you doing that? You know, I just did it. It wasn't stressful for me. And it was actually my stress release to make that bar. I loved it. It was fun. So.
And that's where I was just gonna say, that's where, like, as I'm listening to you say that, it's actually starts to speak to the value of really understanding what makes your spirit sing, and to really relinquish this need to adhere to the ideas of other people. And this concept of self-love and quieting the voices of the world around us, I know, is something else that you talk about in your book. In fact, it's one of the objectives of your book, is that I want to help you to quiet those outside voices. How do we do that? What transition or life experience has to happen for people where they finally go, okay, enough, be quiet. I'm going to live for me now.
Yeah.
You know, in 5 minutes or less, how do we quiet the voices, Christina? Let's go.
There we go. Well, you know, loving your, I mean, when, like I said earlier in the conversation, when I had that suicide attempt, and it should have worked, right? So here I am, I overachieve at everything in my life, but I certainly suck at this one particular area.
Thank goodness.
So, you know, all joking aside, the reason is that, so that for me was the turning point I needed to be able to learn to love myself. And I have basically spent the last 30 years trying to do that. Am I 100% loving myself? No, but do I have higher regard for myself than I did yesterday? Absolutely. And so as a recovering people pleaser, I can tell you that one of the key things here is to put yourself first. Now, this is really hard for people, especially women, because we play so many roles, right? We're wives, we're mothers, we're daughters, we're sisters, we're friends, we're colleagues, we're business owners. But where are you in all of that? Those are all roles. And is there a role that you're playing that's no longer serving you? And where are you in all of that? So coming back to what you were mentioning into the start of this question is, what fuels your soul? What really serves you? What makes you jump for joy? So that's the essence, getting back to that essence of you, because we lose ourselves in all these roles. And so for myself, it's really quieting the voice of others has been very difficult, because I've been very sensitive and I valued other people's opinions of me over my opinion of me. So I put more weight in what other people thought of me than what I thought of them or what I thought of myself. And I had a really hard lesson it's written in Beyond the Label, but it's also on my blog, and it's an article called Letting Go. And my naturopathic doctor taught this to me. There was an incident, and I was really upset for days, weeks even, about this particular incident. So I got some counseling from him, and he basically said to me, Chris, you know, you can do what you're doing, which is wiping. So I'm sorry, I'll just preface this with the understanding of boundaries. So to be emotionally resilient and to be able to really learn to love yourself, you have to set some boundaries and you have to understand when your boundaries are crossed. So, you know, when I'm in clinic with patients, we do a physical exercise where I stand at one end of the room, they're at the other end of the room. I ask them to walk towards me until they feel, to stop when they feel they need to stop or feel comfortable. That represents the physical boundary. And we talk about that with our children. We say, get out of that child's bubble, or don't let them in your bubble, right? So we all have that physical boundary, which is also speaks to our energy field or our aura. But then we have what's called emotional boundaries. And these emotional boundaries are whenever you have an emotional reaction, which can be as subtle as raising your eyebrow, thinking to yourself, huh, I wonder why they looked at me that way. To like basically losing your cool because your child isn't packing their backpack in time to get out the door to go to school.
Oh my gosh, that's me every day. And that literally, was me it's as well. Like you were there with me yesterday.
So that emotional reactivity, yeah, and that was, so I talk about that in Beyond the Label.
What page?
Yeah, I should look, I'm going to try and look it up for you. I'll come back to that. I'll send it to you. But
okay, brilliant.
Yeah, it's really, and it was exactly that example that I learned that I sought help. There you go, page 248.
Thank you.
So Dr. Hughes, Dr. Jason Hughes, phenomenal ND, he taught me about managing boundaries. So basically, here's how he said it. He said, Chris, whenever you have an emotional reaction, you got to ask yourself this question. And I apologize in advance because I'm going to swear here. He said, whose shit is it and whose diaper is it in? So it might be
so
your
good.
Shit, right? Mm-hmm. It might be your stuff. It means you got to do the work. But it could be the other person's shit. And therefore, you don't need to have your hand in their diaper. So with this particular incident I was talking about, it was basically a family member said to me, who did not really know me, so this is on my in-law side, I'd only really spent 10 hours with me, basically said to me, I'm sick and tired of dealing with you and your mental illness. And it really hurt me to hear those words. And so anyways, when I got the counseling from Jason, he said, Chris, you can continue doing what you're doing, which is wiping the shit off your face that's being thrown at you from someone else's diaper, or you can simply step out of the way and learn to let it go and learn this. And here, finally, getting to the point that other people's opinions of you are none of your business.
Yes.
And that's a quote by Wayne Dyer. Now, Jason had to repeat that to me 6 times.
Only 6 times?
Yeah, well, okay, you know, I was like, what? Pardon me? Can you say that again?
That's so great.
And so that, like, a light bulb went off, and therein, it was the first sort of opportunity for me to take a look at this piece, because when you are a puppet on the string, because you're placing other people's opinions of you higher than your opinion, you become a puppet on the string. And I think this is really difficult, because there's a word that's a dirty word that I think we look at it as a dirty word. Well, maybe I'll ask you, what do you think of this word when I say it, and what comes up for you? And it's this word, selfish.
Yeah, it's right? True. It is. It's not bright and pink.
It's not. We don't paint it, but it is bright and pink. And that's the thing. It's self-preservation.
Yes.
Right? We have to change. But I think this is why people have a hard time loving themselves. And because women are reared to be quiet and subservient. And then we associate loving ourselves as being somehow selfish. And then that word is full of power for a lot of us. So we have to shift that in our mind to understand that this is self-care. And then when you can do that, you know, hopefully you won't, you know, we spend a lot of our time trying to be desirable and accepted by everybody else. But we have no idea of who we are, what we need, and what matters to us. So the concept of loving ourselves is foreign. I mean, we're not really taught this. So there you go. So that's, I think, a place to start, is by start asking yourself, you know, whose opinion matters more here in the room?
Which I think takes a lot of bravery. Like we have so many entrepreneurs who listen to this and they're like, listen, like for me to get to that place where I'm successful, it's important that I project something out into the world so that people think a certain thing about me. But I've reached a point in my life where I feel like very quickly, and maybe it's just the number of people that I come in contact with on a daily basis, but I can see through that so fast. Like the people who genuinely own their space and their confidence, and it's not about passion, it's about purpose. There's just something different about it. And it takes work to get to purpose over passion.
And that word success as well is another one. I remember this interesting conversation with another one of my dear friends. We sat across from lunch. We both went to commerce together. I graduated. We were working, you know, in the corporate world. And we sat down and we were having this conversation. And she said, and we were talking about another good friend of ours. And well, not about her. We were talking about success. And she said, well, who do you think is the most successful of our class? We all graduated from high school together, and then we all went on to university together. I don't know. I just never thought about that, right? Who do you think? And then she said who she thought. And then I asked her, why? Why do you think she's the most successful? And she said, well, because she makes the most money.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Right? And therein, I did a full stop. I said, well, you know, there's a lot more definitions to success than just the material side.
Yep.
So a great book I read by Robert Holden, which is called Success Intelligence. If you're not familiar with Robert Holden, I would encourage you to check out that book. And so that, I think, is another problem, because our society is driven by this material concept of success. And that is a false, you know, that's ego driven.
Right.
So we want to be careful with that, I think. And I think that's why our society is so off track, because we're pursuing the wrong shiny object.
It's always about status, right?
Right.
Yeah,
right.
Absolutely. You know, one of the things I want to look at when we're talking about your book is the concept of stigma around some of these pieces. Mm. So we're talking about shame. We're talking about, you know, genuinely loving yourself and doing that work. And I think part of this is people are trying to avoid certain stigmas. They're stick handling sometimes the truth. Is there in the patients that you worked with, is there a common stigma that you've confronted with yourself, or that you hear your patients articulating that we should just call out and lay on the table while we're at it?
Yeah.
While we're just ripping everyone's world apart and challenging them on so many levels, should we just go full picture here?
Well, we can, and maybe I should ask, you know, I mean, part of me wants to put the question back to you to see where your stigma is around mental illness. just to get a pulse on it, or I can answer the question. What do you want me to do?
Yeah. You know, I feel like maybe I have a biased, perspective on it. You know, I've had family members who have confronted this, but I see it in my practice. I see it in my practice so often. But you know, I have to catch myself sometimes where I'm like, oh, you know, I think this person might be dancing around an actual issue here. And I have to stop myself every time and be like, okay, are you ready to go there? Or is it easier just to hang out on the surface? And I think those are not necessarily stigma words, but they're stigma actions, right? Maybe this will pass. Maybe this will. And it's certainly in a clinical context, it's my responsibility to go there and ask those right questions, but also with friends. Like, it's the notion of sort of sweeping it under the rug, I think, is something that people confront frequently.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I think that the common stigma with bipolar disorder in particular is that we are, that we're crazy, that we're violent, that we are not to be trusted, that we're psycho, really. Mm-hmm. And I mean, whatever that, you know, term means, and that we're not like other people. And it's funny, you know, so there's the stigma from society. There's also self-stigma as well. The, you know, the belief that you are weak or damaged because of your illness. And I think, I mean, I'm so protective of bipolar disorder in the sense that it's like, I'm very defensive of it in the sense that I hid this, right, for many years. I've just come out with this book that I have this label. Although, you know, I mean, maybe people knew, because sometimes obviously mania is pretty difficult to hide. But I was very sensitive to people knowing about this condition. And part of the reason was because what do we all want? We all want to be loved. We all want to be accepted. And we all want to be normal, right? So this word normal packs a lot of punch for people like me who have been given all these labels. And I think what I try to explain to patients is, you know, there's this spectrum. Okay. There's this normal spectrum that society has defined as normal. But then if you look at, like, if we were going to do a graph, so at the very bottom we have suicide, and at the very, very top we have mania and psychosis. And right in the middle we have this band that's considered normal, right? And what our society does is we don't really like people who are on their fringes. We don't understand those states unless you've been in them. You don't really get it, which is one of the reasons why I think my practice is so busy, is because I not only bring clinical experience to the table, but I bring lived experience with this. And so what I say to my patients is, you know what? This whole spectrum from mania to suicide, that whole spectrum, you are normal. This is normal. It's just that it's not comfortable to be there. And not everybody gets there. So in a way, you really are a gift. And you need to look at this label, not the way I looked at it, which was like it was a curse. You need to look at this like this is a gift. But it does have to be managed, because it's difficult to function in society when you're delusional, right?
Fair.
Right.
So, you know, in your journey, working with Abram Hoffer and really starting to understand nutrition and high-dose vitamins and the capacity for some of these other substances to have positive influence on your health and by consequence, mental health. When we talk about the role that naturopathic medicine has to play in this, in your book, you talk about four elements of one's health that you feel are most important to address. Take us through those quickly so that people can actually have an understanding that once we get past the stigma and once we want to hit something head on, that there are options beyond just pharmaceuticals to manage where you're at.
Hmm. Yeah. And that is the reason why I wrote this book, because, you know, our medicine is amazing and it gets no recognition. And so when a person walks in, say to the emergency room and they feel like they're suicidal, there's no mention of naturopathic medicine. So one of the reasons, and I want to be clear here, I'm not anti-Western medicine, but what I am is it's not this or that form of medicine. It's this and that. Right. So what I explain to people is there's four aspects to you as a person. There's the physical, the mental, the emotional, and spiritual. And our Western system is focused on the physical pretty much that's it. Unless you're seeing a psychologist, then you're going to be perhaps definitely touching into the mental, emotional, and perhaps the spiritual side. In my opinion, we need to be looking at all four aspects if we're going to have a completely healthy system, healthy person. But with respect to the physical, because that's what most people are used to talking about, we want to understand that there's three macro systems within you: your neurotransmitters, your neuroendocrine or hormonal system, and your organs of detoxification. And all of these macro systems are working together within your body. It's not like there's silos separating them. Unlike in how we practice the medicine, where there are separate departments, right? The endocrinologist doesn't talk to the cardiologist, which doesn't talk to the psychiatrist. But in the body, they're all talking to each other. So the way that I go about supporting you as an individual, and what I've written in the book, is there's 10 steps that we have to address in order to encompass these four overarching principles, being the physical, mental, emotional, and spiritual. So the 10 steps are the foundation of your health house, so to speak, is diet, sleep, exercise, and then managing stress. And then the next levels we want to look at are your thoughts, then your emotions, how you behave and react in the world, your environment from three perspectives: quality of the air, food, and water. There's chemicals everywhere. And what we have to understand is these chemicals can block receptors. So the hormones you're making and the neurotransmitters, they might not be able to get in the cell because there's a bouncer blocking the door. And mental health is viewed as a deficiency problem, right? You're not making enough of a certain neurotransmitter, usually. So what do we try to do? We give you more of it. But what if, and this is why, and you probably see this in practice a lot, people start an antidepressant, but they don't get better.
Right, well, frequently, that, yeah.
Yeah, and maybe that's because either it's the wrong macro system, the problem lies somewhere else, or there's something blocking the receptors. So you could be making enough, but it's not getting in. The second concept with the environment is this concept that I touched on earlier, which is this idea of epigenetics, which basically means genes load the gun, but lifestyle pulls the trigger. The last concept of the environment is this concept of neuroplasticity, which means that there's nothing fixed about you in any way, shape, or form. You can make new neural pathways. You can learn to think a new way. And then the last step, the 10 steps, is spirituality. And learning to love and accept yourself. And I wrap it all up in that. And you can, I'd love people to answer this question for themselves right now. You know, on a scale of 1 to 10, how much do you love yourself? And often the answer I get is quite low for women. Mm-hmm. And again, that's what we were talking about earlier. This is really the work that needs to be done. You know, we really need to set about learning how to love and accept ourselves.
Absolutely. Christina, how would you define health?
Oh boy, right? Health. I mean, that's all we've got, really. So there's this idea, we talk about the mind, body, and the spirit. And so it's about being in a state of balance or homeostasis or equilibrium for you as an organism, as an entity, within those three aspects. And, you know, health is really a difficult concept for people, because some people think, like I used to think I was healthy, and I clearly was not. So this is the thing. You know how you feel in your body, but you don't know how good you can feel. Mm-hmm. Right? And so we kind of take our health for granted, but truly health is really the only thing you've got. Because if you don't have your health, what's going to end up happening? You're not going to exist anymore eventually, right? So health has got to be about a state of this vibrancy and vitality, and it is more than what you eat. I mean, we could talk about an apple, and I think we could have four people in the room, and we probably won't agree on what a healthy apple is, right? Is it the one that's genetically modified? Is it the one that you grew with the seed that you picked and planted in your own garden with no pesticides? I mean, which one's the healthier apple, right? So health is a tough question to answer.
I was thinking, man, that question of the healthy apple is especially difficult if you had four naturopaths in the room.
Yeah.
Believe it or not. Absolutely. It's not an easy question, which is why I actually just enjoy asking it.
Yeah.
I enjoy asking it so much. You know, when we talk about health and the components that come into it, there's always actions and philosophies and principles that drive that. Each month, I'm featuring a new Anthropology quiz to help you unlock and uncover some of the physical performance blocks that may be holding you back from your true potential. When you know better, you can do better. To learn more or to take the quiz, head on over to meganwalker.com/Anthropology quiz. The second part of the interview, which is actually quite quick, is a section we called key performance indicators or KPIs. So just like we would have these in our business, I think that we also have these as individuals in our own lives that help to inform how we achieve health. So if you will indulge me, I've got 6 quick questions for you.
Okay.
First one, do you have a consistent morning routine? And if so, can you share it?
Yes, I do. So my morning routine consists of gratitude. So I used to go to bed. Now this is probably a little bit dark and deep for people, but I used to go to bed because I spent most of my time in depression, actually wishing that I would not wake up in the morning. And when I woke up in the morning, I did not wake up with, I was like, oh God, another damn day, right? Now I wake up with gratitude that I have another day. So I start with gratitude. And then there's a form of movement involved, whether it's yoga, exercise. And then I finish off the morning with journaling, and I move into the hectic stage of getting, you know, my son off to school. That's my morning routine.
Right. All serenity expires, right? Yeah, I know that well. Yeah. Fiction or nonfiction, what are you reading right now?
I'm actually reading fiction. It's called, because I read a lot of nonfiction, but I'm reading two, so I'm reading both right now. I'm reading fiction and nonfiction. I'm the type of person that has a few books on the go. So I am reading, do you want to know what it's called?
Totally.
Did you ask that?
Oh. Yeah, tell us. I'm like waiting.
Oh, okay. So this is a little bit kind of racy. I'm reading The Queen's Code. Have you heard of The Queen's Code?
No, I haven't.
Okay. By Alison Armstrong, and it's about how to understand men, actually. And it's actually really good.
Is it really, really long?
No, and it's quick.
It's like, and or it, is it very, very short?
It's pretty short. I mean, it's, I don't know how many pages it is. I'm almost done. And I started reading it middle of January. I don't read a ton. I mean, I read at bed for however long as I get. So it might be 5 minutes to an hour, depending on how long it takes me to fall asleep. But anyways, The Queen's Code by Alison Armstrong is what I'm reading. She talks about how women have become frog farmers. So we've basically, instead of turning them into princes, we're turning them into frogs by masturbating them all the time.
Okay, I like it. I'm going to check it out. What is one thing you're most consistent with respect to your health?
Well, the stress management piece and sleep. And it's hard to say one, but stress management, which encompasses sleep and exercise. So I manage my stress by managing my sleep and ensuring that I'm moving my body and releasing stress by pounding it out on the pavement.
Awesome. What is something totally badass about you that people would not otherwise know?
Oh, good. You want to define badass for me?
Badass is a feeling. There's no strict definition.
Oh my gosh. That I completed an Ironman.
Oh my gosh, that's amazing. I was thinking you wrote a book, but I'll take Iron Man. That's pretty awesome. What do you do for fun or play?
I dancing with my son and telling jokes with my son, watching sitcoms with my family, just to keep it light and fun, and listening to comedy.
And finally, entrepreneurism. Are we born this way or do we learn to become entrepreneurs?
Oh, man. I think, you know what? I think some people are born this way and I think other people have to learn it. And for myself, I think I'm a little bit of both. I definitely have, I am an entrepreneur now, but it didn't come super easy for me because of all my fear. So, I think I think that everyone can learn this, but I think it does come easier to some, for sure.
Dr. Christina Bjørndal, it was incredible having you here. Where can people learn more about what you are up to?
So at my website, either the clinic website, which is naturalterrain, TERRAIN.com, or just my personal, which is Dr. Christine A with a CH, and then my last name, Bjørndal. But I won't spell it out because
it'll be all in the show notes. Yeah. Yep. We're going to share it with everyone. It's been a pleasure having this conversation today. I really enjoyed it. And I so appreciate the work that you are doing in this world. It is helping a lot of people.
Thank you very much. Thanks for your show. I really appreciate it.
If you enjoyed our conversation and would like to hear more, head on over to Stitcher or iTunes and subscribe to the Anthropology Podcast. We would also really appreciate a quick review. When people have their health, they can change the world. Let us keep you healthy and you go change the world.